It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk to an author who says that the government is over-regulating childhood and parenting.
Now, last night was the second of three presidential debates in the 2016 campaign. 2 days before the debate, the Washington Post published a recording of Donald Trump talking about women in 2005. Here's a clip of that conversation, and be warned that the language might offend some listeners.
I gotta use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the...
That audio was released by the Washington Post from a live mic before an Access Hollywood interview in 2005. After the video became public, Republicans started dropping their support from Trump, including Senator and former presidential candidate John McCain. And today, sources say House Speaker Paul Ryan said he would no longer defend or campaign with Trump, though he did not retract his endorsement.
And we want to know what you thought of this weekend's news at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to that video? Does it change the way you think of the presidential race, or maybe the way you'll vote? And what did you take away from the debate? What stood out for you? You can call in now and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She's a professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again today.
Well, let's start by talking about the release of these Trump tapes just a couple days before the debate. How did this audio set the scene for last night's event?
Well, I mean, I think the people who were watching it and who had been following the story, or even if you were slightly tuned into the story, went into the debate wondering about, you know, how this was going to be brought up and what the candidates were going to say in regard to it. And since it was a town hall style debate, you had members of the public right there with the two candidates. And I have to say, the first half hour or so of the debate was pretty uncomfortable around some of these issues. And so I think that there was a lot of concern with regard to what the tapes revealed and the discussion on them. And from everything that I was reading and hearing, you know, the Trump campaign was very much in a kind of war room mode at Trump Tower, trying to prepare and also, you know, trying to respond to a degree to what the tapes had revealed.
And that topic of the tapes was the first question right out of the gate. And I think Donald Trump didn't add tremendously to what he'd said in his audio response, which came over the weekend. But what was your sense of how that answer unfolded?
Well, I mean, I think the response was one that then was asked. There were a number of follow-up questions that came with regard to his response. While Trump may have wanted to sort of move on, the questioners or the moderators, you know, did follow up with some more questions about, you know, his understanding of what sexual assault might constitute, or what might constitute sexual assault, and you know, what people should make of these tapes.
Yeah, here's a listen to Anderson Cooper asking Donald Trump if he understood that he was bragging about sexually assaulting women. Here's a listen.
No, I didn't say that at all. I don't think you understood what was said. This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it. But this is locker room talk.
So we're in a situation in the media and voters, too, trying to parse whether a major party presidential candidate was falsely boasting about groping, sexually assaulting women, or describing something that he had done. Did you see this coming?
Did I see it coming?
Anybody see it coming? I don't know.
I don't know if exactly this, did anybody see this specifically coming, but certainly, you know, Donald Trump has made off-color and, you know, questionable comments with regard to any number of other groups of people or individuals. And so while it was pretty, I don't know, a bit more extreme, it was also not necessarily completely a surprise.
And Hillary Clinton then moved quickly to respond to those tapes and also tie it into other comments Trump had made over the course of the campaign so far and what he said about other groups of people or individuals. And here's a little bit of her answer.
But he never apologizes for anything to anyone. He never apologized to Mr. and Mrs. Khan, the Gold Star family, whose son, Captain Khan, died in the line of duty in Iraq. And Donald insulted and attacked them for weeks over their religion. He never apologized to the distinguished federal judge who was born in Indiana. But Donald said he couldn't be trusted to be a judge because his parents were, quote, Mexican. He never apologized to the reporter that he mimicked and mocked on national television and our children were watching. And he never apologized for the racist lie that President Obama was not born in the United States of America. He owes the president an apology. He owes our country an apology. And he needs to take responsibility for his actions and his words.
Hillary Clinton there responding to the Trump tapes. What did you think of the way that she brought in this out, made it also about these other figures, groups of people in the campaign who'd been affected?
Well, I mean, I think that she was, again, trying to sort of make her argument, which, you know, she sort of articulated in at the convention, in her speech at the Democratic convention, which was really about, you know, sort of evaluating Trump's temperament and whether or not he is qualified in regard to his temperament to be president. And so I think she kind of reiterated that in her response to Trump and with regard to the remarks that were made public on Friday.
Talking about last night's debate in presidential politics with Lily Gorin, we'll go to our callers now. Ellen is on the line in Madison. Ellen, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in and say I'm a lifelong, I'm still a conservative, but I'm no longer a Republican. And I made up my mind a long time ago that I wasn't going to vote for this man. My reaction to the tapes on Friday was the same as it was for everything else that he said and done. I'm not surprised a bit. And I think it's as bad as everything else. And I don't know why it serves as a tipping point for some other people because, you know, the shock jock stuff that he said was every bit as bad as that.
Ellen, I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind my asking, if you're a conservative, you're not voting for the Republican candidate, what are you planning to do with your vote?
I haven't made up my mind yet on that, but I won't be supporting this man. I just find him reprehensible, and he's not a conservative.
Ellen, thanks a lot for that call. And Lily, that's, I guess, what the Trump campaign is worried about, what a lot of Republicans are worried about at this point, that Donald Trump is turning Republicans away from conservatives away from the presidential candidate, maybe down ballot fallout, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we won't know until we have some more polling, but also until Election Day with regard to the impact on the down ballot races, certainly. And there has been, you know, there have been some candidates who are running in Senate races. We have here Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, but also you have Bob Portman in Ohio and so forth. And there is a great concern with regard to whether or not Trump will depress voter turnout for Republicans and thus depress the vote all the way down the ballot, or if people will, you know, come out and vote for Clinton or vote for Gary Johnson or Evan McMorris, I think is his name, for the conservative ticket, and so that they will still come out and vote, but they will not perhaps vote for Trump in as great numbers.
Thank you for that call. Let's take another one now. Heather is with us next in Menominee. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I was just so appalled. I'm a 45-year-old professional woman, and his comments brought back 25 years worth of flashbacks of being groped, propositioned in a professional setting. And it's one, and I'm imagining thousands and thousands of other women felt the same. When you believe that you're on the job, you're conducting yourself professionally, and to have that situation happened to you, it's just absolutely, my heart is pounding. I'm just so furious that something like this could be condemned.
Heather, you're breaking up a little there, but I think we've got the core of what you wanted to say. And Lily, I mean, aside from Heather's really visceral reaction, you can hear how she said her heart was pounding. This is something that's really upset her, and it's brought back memories of many sexual assault victims who are sharing stories online. To take it from that level, that emotional reaction, to the practicality of politics, I mean, has Donald Trump done irreparable damage with women enough? I mean, as I've seen stated before, can you win an election without women if this is what has happened with this Trump tape?
Well, I mean, he's obviously going to have some women who do vote for him in the end. But at the same time, you know, the pollsters keep looking at the demographics, and if you go through poll after poll after poll, there is definitely a gap between white male voters, white female voters, white male educated voters, white female educated voters. Certainly there's a very large gap in terms of there aren't a lot of African Americans, either men or women, who are inclined to vote for him according to the polls that I've seen. But I do think that he's sort of boxing himself in terms of the number of people he has to turn out and who they are. And if you do alienate a whole gender, which is, you know, half the population, and women are about 53% of the folks who come to the polls, it's harder. It's harder to win the Electoral College that way.
We're talking to Lily Gorin right now about last night's presidential debate, the second of three debates between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and the reaction to Friday's release of a video showing Donald Trump describing acts of sexual assault towards women.
We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the debate? Did it change how you see the candidates? What stood out to you? And what do you think of these Trump tapes? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our discussion now with political scientist Lily Gorin, talking about last night's presidential debate as prominent Republicans, some of them withdrew their support for Donald Trump in the aftermath of Friday's video release.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the debate, those videos, the Republican reaction, what comes next, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Another much talked about item, Lily, people were talking a lot about Donald Trump saying he didn't want to say it, but he said he wanted to investigate Hillary Clinton and her private email servers. He would ask his Department of Justice to do that. Here's a listen to that moment.
If I win, I am going to instruct my attorney general to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation, because there has never been so many lies, so much deception. There has never been anything like it, and we're going to have a special prosecutor.
And he said in another moment that Hillary Clinton would be in jail if he were president. Some people saying this isn't really the way we generally talk in representative government type elections. What was your take on that exchange?
That actually, for me, as somebody who studies, you know, American politics and our democracy, was one of the most problematic things that I've heard him say, because basically, that's essentially the kind of threats that you see in autocratic regimes where, you know, strong man governments will jail or otherwise eliminate their political rivals. And that's not how the American democratic process works. Hillary Clinton has been investigated by any number of official agencies and the United States Congress any number of times. And to have that kind of a threat articulated in that way is, I think, really beyond what is tolerable in a kind of democracy that we hope to live in the United States.
And Lily, I want to talk for just a bit about sort of the physical presentation of last night's debate. I started by listening to NPR's coverage. I switched to the cable channels. And it was a very powerful scene to watch Donald Trump kind of the word that's been used is looming at times behind Hillary Clinton walking around on the stage. I mean, what did you make of sort of the body language interactions?
Well, I mean, you sort of see him kind of being in her space in a couple of instances during the course of the debate. And again, you know, she's a smaller woman, he's a larger man, and so when you see that in contrast, it really is kind of striking. And again, you know, she noted afterwards, she was interviewed about it, I think on her plane as she was leaving, and she said that, you know, she sort of knew he was there and sort of felt like it was a little bit strange or bizarre. And that, you know, in her choice, when she wasn't being asked a question, she went to her stool, she sat down, but that he circled around her a lot during the course of her responses.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mike is on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. My comment is about what's going on, and is I'm extremely disappointed the candidates gloss over the tremendous and growing costs of war and global warming, both caused by human activities, especially by the U.S.
Mike, thanks for the call. Not a lot of, a very brief mention of him in the first debate, sort of tangentially mentioned in an audience question about energy and the environment. But Lily, global warming, not a topic that's been brought up a lot.
No, it hasn't been. And for a lot of people, it is a particular concern. President Obama has been talking about it a lot in his last bit of his second term now, but it hasn't been a topical question that's been brought up in either the first or the second debates. There's, of course, one more debate, I believe, on October 19th.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now, professor of political science at Carroll University, talking about last night's debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in light of the revelations of the Trump tape. And one thing that came up, a change in position, at least it seemed to be, on Trump's taxes and what had been said prior, and then in between we had the New York Times piece revealing some portion of Trump's tax returns, so we had a little bit of information. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Did you use that $916 million loss to avoid paying personal federal income taxes?
Of course I do. Of course I do. And so do all of her donors, or most of her donors. I know many of her donors. Her donors took massive tax write-offs. A lot of my write-off was depreciation and other things that Hillary, as a senator, allowed.
So what do you make of that particular exchange about taxes? This has been an ongoing issue in the race, Lily.
Yeah, and again, you know, we had the story in the New York Times is now, I think, about a week or two ago, where somebody had sent the New York Times 3 pages of Trump's tax return from the mid-90s, and they, you know, they investigated whether they were authentic, and they determined that they were, and they evaluated, you know, they had sort of tax reporters and tax specialists, and I think they found the accountant who had actually prepared it. And they evaluated it based on, you know, what the potential was that he might have, in fact, not paid taxes for about 20 years. And so he was asked about it again, but he hasn't released any other tax returns. So it's hard to know what any other tax returns say with regard to whether he has or hasn't paid taxes.
Another theme that came up was just the general nature of the election. Last question of the debate, asking people to say nice things about each other, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton mentioned Donald Trump's children as a positive, but then she went on to talk about the campaign in general and the conflict in it. Here's a listen.
This is not an ordinary time, and this is not an ordinary election. We are going to be choosing a president who will set policy for not just 4 or 8 years, but because of some of the important decisions we have to make here at home and around the world, from the Supreme Court to energy and so much else. And so there is a lot at stake. It's one of the most consequential elections that we've had. And that's why I've tried to put forth specific policies and plans, trying to get it off of the personal and put it on to what it is I want to do as president.
Whether she's wanted to do that or not, Lily, has that happened? Are we focusing more on policy than we are on personality and character?
A lot of this campaign from the primaries forward, in particular during the primary season, The Republican primary has, a lot of it has been about personality, and then into the general election, we've now had a lot of discussion of personalities, in particular foibles and so forth, and occasionally a little bit about a policy or two, but it's less about policy from what I can tell.
And Lily, as we start to wrap up, many people called this debate ugly, or said it was historically brutal, difficult to watch. And based on all of that, how do you think the third debate will go? And is there any indication that maybe either side might decline to debate that third time?
I don't know if either side will decline to debate. There's some, you know, there's speculation. There was speculation whether or not Trump would debate at all initially, and whether he would, you know, he would come out for the second debate. It certainly should be another opportunity for Americans to hear from the two candidates for president, possibly have a little bit more conversation about policy. It will be not a town hall. It will be with one moderator, Chris Wallace. And so it should be a debate conversation that perhaps does integrate more policy substance.
And Lily, NBC Wall Street Journal poll came out today, showed a big lead, by one measure, 11-point lead nationally for Hillary Clinton. Huge. That's just one poll, and sometimes one poll can be an outlier and misleading. But do you see the race turning more and more toward Hillary Clinton before and after this weekend?
Well, I mean, I saw the NBC poll, and it's a very small sample size. So I would, you know, wait to see more polls. Also, the NBC polls tend to be really solid ones, but it was not a great big sample size. So it could be an outlier. I don't think that the sort of news from Friday and the video and audio would necessarily help Trump, but it's who knows.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. She joined us to talk about last night's presidential debate after, in many ways, unprecedented weekend in presidential politics.
Coming up after the news, we talk to a writer who says that with more health and safety regulations for kids, the government is interfering too much in parenting. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Gemma Tarlak joins us for a look at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science, including efforts to send spaceships to another solar system. Very, very tiny spaceships.
First, our next guest argues that Uncle Sam is the worst helicopter parent in America. She makes the case that a lot of government regulations are interfering in parental decision-making and stop people from raising their families as they see fit.
Abby Schachter joins us now. She's a regular contributor to publications like Acculturated, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and the Weekly Standard. And her new book is called No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting. Abby, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Well, Abby, how did you become what you call a captain mommy?
Basically, it was because in my state, Pennsylvania, they have banned allowing caretakers to swaddle babies in daycare. And swaddling was my big cause. It's what helped our four children sleep when they were young. And the state came in and said, well, you can't do it. And I sort of, that was a bridge too far for me, and I suddenly turned into a captain mommy fighting for my rights as a parent.
Well, how different would you say the level of governmental involvement for parents today is than it was maybe 20 years ago?
I think the biggest problem we have today is that private decision-making is defined as a public problem, and has to be decided by government. So I'd say 20 years ago, if you wanted to let your kid walk to the playground unsupervised, or let them ride their bike around the neighborhood, or walk to school, that would be your decision, yours and your child's, I suppose. And now it's much more the decision of police departments, school principals, crossing guards, and they get involved in telling parents what they can and can't do in terms of their child raising their own children.
And as we said, you refer to yourself as a captain mommy, and there are also captain daddies out there, too. And you say these are parents who are advocating to stem the flow of governmental regulations that interfere with parenting. I mean, but is this a movement now? Is this something that's more than just you and a handful of other people who are concerned about this?
Well, I think I wish it would become more of a movement. I think there are definitely more and more people coming to the realization. It happens in small ways, right? So you have parents, for example, in Florida. What did they band together to fight for? Recess. They feel, and correctly, I think, that kids need time to run around during the school day. And in their school districts in Florida, they were getting no recess. I mean, some places it was down to like 5 minutes, and some schools there was none. And that's what got them energized and got them fighting for their rights. For some parents, it's play. For other parents, it's what they want to send their kids to eat at school. And for me, it was swaddling. So I think that it is individual parents, but as people realize there are other people like them, hopefully they'll take up the charge.
Wouldn't you say, though, that the government has a role in making childhood better? If you look at the pages of history, child labor laws passed in the progressive era, or compulsory primary education, isn't there a role there to be played?
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, the Supreme Court said exactly what you've just echoed, which is that parents have a right to parent their children with the exception of providing them an education. So certainly the government has a role. What I'm saying is, if you look around at all the cases of parents arrested for private decisions that they made towards their child, letting them be alone, the government's decided we must breastfeed, school lunches are determined by Washington, D.C., and not by the local community. These are all areas in which decisions that used to be made on the spot by parents or by the local community have been just taken away and really made exacerbated and made one size fits all, which doesn't really fit many, many families.
Abby Schachter is with us now. She has a new book out. It's called No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting. And Abby, you just mentioned an example saying the government says we must breastfeed. And obviously many parents choose to use formula
right
instead of breastfeeding. So what is the case there that you're making?
Well, for example, if you look at the rules of Obamacare, everybody is now paying for free breast pumps for women to breastfeed. And employers are mandated to provide a space to breastfeed, that is, to pump breast milk, which is not a bathroom. And these are both areas. There are lots of city and state hospitals where formula has been put under lock and key and been taken away from being close at hand for new moms, because the ideology is, well, we've got to push mothers into the best choice that we think they can make, instead of leaving it up to women to decide for themselves.
Another area you look at is food and nutrition, and some of this overlaps with concerns about obesity for children as well. What do you see there that makes you worried?
It worries me a lot that there are children across the country that have been taken out of the custody of their parents because they're obese. Now, they are definitely suffering from a terrible health condition. And your heart breaks for these stories. But in most of these cases, the entire family is suffering from a health problem. And the state's decision is to say, well, we don't really care about you, adults, because we can only take legal custody of the child. So we're going to take them away. And what shocks me is the idea that you can rectify one harm by causing another. Do we not care about the emotional or psychological harm caused to children who are removed from the bosom of their family?
I want to talk about something that dovetails with this conversation. One of the things you talk about is the National School Lunch Program, as well as the First Lady's push for kids to be healthier, to be more active. And you say that some of these efforts, they're misguided and they have maybe unintended effects. What do you see there?
Well, I mean, one of the problems that I have is that the United States Department of Agriculture, which is the department of the government that administers the school lunch program, has really complicated competing interests, because it is also in charge of agriculture in the United States. So it is charged with competing tasks, because while it is trying to, let's say, feed nutritious lunches to millions of children, it's also trying to make sure that the dairy industry is doing well, that the cattle industry is doing well, that all of these agricultural industries are protected classes. And these things are competing with something that should be pretty simple, which is feeding children in school. And it's become such a complicated matter that there are school districts, when they can afford it, that have hired professional chefs to be able to manage the menu, that they now have to comply with the regulations.
So the regulations may be onerous, but on the other hand, the CDC has also said that the prevalence of obesity has dropped 43% among children between the age of 2 and 4 between the years of 2004 and 2012. So, I mean, I guess on the other hand, if these programs are working, why not go with it?
I would say I'd push back only insofar as saying, how about doing something a little bit simpler, like more activity? I think the First Lady was completely right on when her program was dealing with the question of exercise and motion and movement. She was totally correct. And, the image of her dancing with school children and involving them in activity, I thought was terrific. But when you move into, when you stray from something that's sort of common sense, get the kids up and moving, to, okay, now we're going to force feed them according to a diet that, that really is mandated from one place in the country. So, for example, I spoke to a seventh grader the other day, and she was really upset because she can only get low-fat milk in her cafeteria. And she read the nutrition information, and she saw how much sugar there is in low-fat milk. And she's skinny as a rail. She needs the fat. So why can't she get whole milk opt for whole milk instead of low-fat milk? No, because the USDA says there's only one type of milk. Or what if she's lactose intolerant? Why should she have to get milk on her tray in the first place?
We're talking right now with Abby Schachter. She is a Pittsburgh-based writer and the author of the new book called No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see what our guest is saying? Too much government regulation affecting how parents parent, how schools feed kids, daycares, things like that. Do you think there are health and safety regulations that are stopping people from raising their families as they see fit? Do you see positives and negatives? If you're a teacher, you work in childcare, I'd love to hear from you as well. And, of course, parents. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Abby Schachter. She's a Pittsburgh-based writer and the author of the new book, No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting.
We want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Our guest says government health, safety, and hygiene regulations are interfering with choices that should be left up to parents. Do you see this happening in your home, in your school, in your child care, in your neighborhood? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Abby, we've got a comment here from Matt in Wausau who says, where does your guest live that doesn't allow children to ride their bikes around or take a walk? It isn't happening in Wausau. Children aren't political commodities, as your guest suggests. Government isn't the inflated problem, she suggests, either. That's from Matt in Wausau who's saying that's not his reality.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And it is true. It's not to say that there aren't any children riding their bikes anywhere in America, but there are, as Lenore Skenazy, who mans the Free Range Kids blog and who wrote the foreword to my book, chronicles every day, there are stories from across the country of parents who have allowed their kids to go out unsupervised. And they get the police and child welfare after them constantly. There was a father in Connecticut who nearly got arrested because the police showed up when he took his teenage sons to a frozen river to just see nature. And these fire trucks and police cars showed up to berate him for doing something that was potentially dangerous for his children. There was a woman in Texas who wrote to Lenore basically to explain how her son, who had just been outside her door, was essentially was brought home by the police and then interviewed with without her being present by child welfare sometime later, all about their house, their family life, suggesting that there was something wrong with her decision to let him walk around his neighborhood by himself. So while I'm very glad to hear that in this gentleman's community he hasn't seen this problem, it is something that is happening in many, many other places in the United States.
But do you think the reason we've heard of, say, a case like the one you just told us about with the kids being, or the family being penalized for playing near the icy river, is because they are outliers and because most of the time, maybe the enforcement you're talking about isn't that extreme?
Well, my question is, why should there be any enforcement at all? In all of these cases, nothing has happened to the child. So I'm asking myself, why are the police and child welfare involved? Do they have nothing else to do? Is there no violence? Is there no crime? Is there no real abuse and neglect that child welfare services should be looking at? And this is part of the problem that I have, which is that if you look at all of the things that child welfare is supposed to be watching, their mandate has become so broad. Their definition of what is safe or what is abuse or what is neglect is so broad that it encompasses a whole range of very normal activity. And they then miss cases, and they can't possibly keep up with all the work that they're generating for themselves.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Tiffany joining us in Kenosha. Tiffany, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I was thinking about like the diet that the schools are enforcing, and I think that a lot of that is targeted at kids who don't have that able ability to get that nutrition at home. It's so that the school is providing the stuff that they can't get at home and that they need, and they're kind of filling that thing. So I don't think that it's fair to say that everybody in the community is, like, suffering because they're putting these rules out there for the diets when it's made to benefit the children.
Tiffany, thank you for that call. And what about that point, Abby? I mean, there are children who live in food scarce households. They eat snacks, they eat breakfast sometimes and lunches at school, and these are important fail-safes that the schools have, these nutrition programs, and people benefit.
Well, I totally agree with Tiffany, and she's highlighting actually a very interesting problem, which is she's basically said that the rule for the majority should be set by the exceptions, right? We understand that there's a minority of kids in many communities who are in less nutritious or leading less nutritious lives, and we want to solve for that. That's a great impulse. The question is, how are you managing to do that? And are you essentially saying, well, because we have to set one bar, we're going to make it for the exception and not for the rule.
I mean, in Wisconsin, there are huge numbers of children. I believe it's over 50% that do get free and reduced school lunches. So I don't know, for at least in Wisconsin, if we're talking about a minority.
Well, I mean, if you take the overall, so what I would say is it would be great if the state of Wisconsin, or even more granular, the specific school districts could design food programs for themselves. Why can't the school districts be in charge of their own food service? Why does it have to be a national thing? Why is that better? Shouldn't the state of Wisconsin or the individual school districts, I mean, again, this is not rocket science. Feeding children is not rocket science, and parents have been doing it for centuries, right? It's one of the most basic things we do. So if we're now saying that the schools have to do it in place of parents, which is essentially what we are suggesting. There's so many kids who are deprived. We have to replace good nutrition in the schools. Fine, but bring the problem closer to home. Have the school districts themselves, or at least at the state level, decide what's more readily available, what's cheaper for them to provide. Why is it taken away from local communities and put in the hands of unaccountable bureaucrats? If Tiffany found that the school lunches at her school were inappropriate for her child, her recourse is really limited, because how is she going to get to the person in Washington who was responsible for designing the menu?
Abby Schachter is with us right now. She's a regular contributor to publications like Acculturated, Pittsburgh Times Review, and her new book is out. It's called No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting. And we'll go next to Ken in Wisconsin Dells. Ken, hi.
Hi. My comment, after working for 20 years in education and dealing with a lot of parents, is I'm very thankful that the government is there to instruct parents and provide some guidelines, because I've seen too many times when parents simply are not up to the task. And I'm sorry, but no child has to drink the milk that's provided at school. No child has to eat the lunch that's at school. Parents are free to send a sack lunch with their children, any lunch that they want to. This question becomes, okay, if we want to take it that what the school is providing, then that's what they get. And I see no problem at all with having it mandated what that lunch should be. It should be a healthy lunch.
Ken, thanks a lot for that comment. And Ken says he's thankful for those government guidelines, that there are a lot of families that need assistance figuring out the nutrition pieces of the puzzle.
That may be the case, and I'm glad that those. The argument I'm making is not to say there shouldn't be school lunch, right? I'm advocating that that the way the government is doing it at the moment is too one size fits all, and while Ken may feel that from his experience, he thinks that the parents in his community couldn't be trusted to make a decent lunch, or the school was making a better lunch for the children than the parents would have. There are other parents who would disagree. I spoke to a parent who felt that they were reporting a story about a girl whose lunch had been taken away from her and replaced with something that, in fact, wasn't, to the mother's taste, not healthier. There is a school in Chicago where the principal banned any parent from bringing their own home-packed lunch with their child, because the school said, well, we can't control what's in that lunch, and it might be junk, and so we don't want to allow any outside food in the school. So while I think that we have to understand that as much as some examples may work, there are many, many parents, and this was really why I wrote the book. I wanted to find out, am I the only person who ran up against this problem? And what I found was that I really didn't know the half of it. There are a lot of parents who have run into these problems, and they really feel that there isn't much they can do.
And Abby, I want to ask you, as we start to wrap up here, what can parents do if they agree with you and they do want more control over raising their kids and some of these choices that families can make?
Well, I think there are good examples across the country. I spoke to a dad in California who basically devoted his front lawn to a play space so that his kids and neighborhood kids would have a safe place to be outside and not in front of a TV screen, and that became his cause. There are parents, as I said before, who have gotten together and are really working with politicians in their school districts in Florida for more recess. I think that the biggest thing that parents can realize is that if they see a problem with something happening, or they feel that they have had a run-in with authorities
Abby, I'm so sorry, but we're out of time for that last statement, but we appreciate that. Abby Schachter is with us. She's the author of No Child Left Alone, Getting the Government Out of Parenting. You may be wondering what you're listening to there. It's not a construction vehicle or anything. It's actually the very adorable sounds of a baby polar bear playing in the middle of a kiddie pool filled with ice.
That's from a video posted by the Oregon Zoo. That's the state of Oregon, not the Wisconsin community of Oregon. And then that video caught our eye.
Right. And, you know, I think many of us will agree it was a weird weekend and a political debate that people have described as the most painful in presidential history. It seemed like a baby polar bear frolicking in a tub of ice would be fun.
Right. And you kind of have to see it. So we have it posted on the Central Time Facebook page. And I also put up there an interview we did a while back with someone who talked about the joys of watching fun videos online. This is cat videos or something, but evidently there's a good positive psychological benefit to what a lot of us think as frivolous online videos.
Right, there's actually a therapeutic effect when it comes to watching those cat videos that people make fun of and yet they still watch. Hopefully the same thing, therapy watching a baby polar bear cavort in ice.
Watch in good health at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time.